All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Canadians, what the fuck Knicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. I'm sitting in a different room than I usually do up here in Canada because there's some sort of massive event going on just below my building across the street in front of the art gallery, Vancouver Art Gallery, I believe it is. There's a lot of things going on in that courtyard. And I don't know what it is, but it sounds exciting. A lot of applause, music that is clearly not music I'm familiar with. It seems like a very exciting event that I am a block and a half away from and not going to. Why don't I just walk out there and see what's up, just to see all those people together clapping and cheering? I've done it before. There's been some protests and some other stuff out there, but I don't know if you're hearing that, but it is happening. What is going on with you? Are you okay? Is everything all right? Where are you at in your life? Is it all right? Are you busy? Are you washing something? Dishes? Are you on a treadmill? What is happening? Right? Today on the show, I talked to Anna Akana. She's a comedian. She's an actor. She has a popular YouTube channel where she does a lot of videos on mental health. Now, I don't, again, this is where we're at with the show after so many years where I've kind of missed a couple of generations of comics. I don't know when it happened, but all of a sudden, like, I'm the old man on the mountain here. And I didn't know Anna from Comedy Store, which is primarily the place I work, but I met her at my gym. And I saw her at one of my shows at Dynasty Typewriter. And it turns out she works out at my gym. And she introduced herself. She said she was a comic. And I'm like, really? And I don't know why, if I don't know somebody, I'm like, how do I not know you? But I don't know hardly any of them anymore. It's a sad thing about getting old. I don't know who's doing anything. And how would I? Even with my current scrolling addiction, I'm not getting a ton of new comics. Well, anyway, she tells me she's a comic. And she's a big fan of mine because of the stuff I talk about, the kind of darkness and the cynicism, and I'm like, well, thank you. And she said she had a one-person show going on at Dynasty Typewriter, which is a venue I work at a lot. And I was like, all right, well, I'll come see it. And it's not easy to get me out, but she had said she had written a book about her sister dying from suicide, and the show was sort of based around that, and that she, you know, was like the way I handled it in my work, grief. And I thought, all right, well, I'll go. And I went, and it was like really, it was moving, and it's hard to do comedy about heavy stuff. And anybody who takes up the challenge because they have to, and it's in their heart to do it, you know, I definitely respect. Pretty ballsy, I'll tell you that. So after I saw the show and I'd see her around, I was like, well, let's do the podcast. It's just so weird that I'm wary at first of young comics because I just don't know them. But then, like, I know comics, and she has a lot of stuff to talk about that I can relate to, you know, stalker situations, grief, and then there's this whole other world. Like, and I always assume that younger comics, like, they're struggling. Like, I struggled when I was a young comic. And it turns out, like, she's got a fucking ton of shit going on. You know, this whole world of YouTube, I don't know anything about that. I'm an old man. I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 20th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for tickets and to see all the latest updates to my dates that have been rescheduled for next year. And sadly, but not terribly sadly, there's going to be more of those because I'm about to close this deal for this independent film I'll be doing, which is going to be good. And I think it will be. It's going to be a challenge for me, but I'm going to be, you know, definitely in the movie, the star of the movie. And it's a big opportunity. And I apologize for rescheduling the dates. But oddly, you'll be helping me because I'll be shooting an HBO special at some point next year, probably in the spring. And these dates, when I move them up, it'll have a nice flow to it. I'm sorry if it screws up your scheduling. And also, as a side note, please use the links on my site to get the tickets. Don't just go look for my name for tickets in your town, because most of the time, the links that come up are scalper sites. And two things, you'll be paying more for the tickets if you go to those sites, and you'll have a difficult time refunding them because of the change. But if you work through the venue or through whatever the venue's ticketing operation is, that's not an issue. And again, I apologize for the inconvenience. So I know you're wondering, how did the show with Alejandro Escovedo go? After I spoke to you last week about the nerves and everything else, you know, I went down there to the Pearl here in Vancouver. Alejandro was there, and they were doing a sound check, watching him set up. We had some laughs. We did some talking. We did the sound check, and it went good. I didn't know if I would have the guts or the wherewithal to kind of do Beast of Burden and free myself to kind of riff through it like Ronnie and Keith do. But his guitar player was solid. His guitar player opened the show even. His name's James Mastro. Been around a long time. Great player. He opened the show with his stuff. And then, you know, he played in his band. And him and I worked out a thing for Beast of Burden and for Like a Hurricane, the Neil Young tune. And in soundcheck, I was like, we fucking nailed this thing. It was great. So, and I was so nervous heading into this, and it was very relaxed. And then I thought after that, I had 2 hours to be like, well, that was probably it. It's going to be different with people in there. But they did their whole show, and it was great. It was great to see Alejandro and the band. And they brought me up, and I was pretty comfortable. I guess all that, you know, playing with guys at Largo, with the dudes I play with, has sort of paid off. And I kind of like, just let myself take the risk and maybe fuck up, but just do the riffs that I could do throughout Beast of Burden. Obviously, I'm no Ron Wood, but, you know, we got the vibe going and it worked out. And then it was perfect. It was great. Great experience. The lead was good. I felt good about it. And then on Like a Hurricane, that was great too. Did some nice leads on that. And then the song kind of fell apart at the end because we didn't know where Alejandro wanted to go. But it didn't fall apart, but the ending was a little abrupt because I think he popped a string. And whatever the case was, it wasn't my fault. But it sounded good, and it was a real fucking thrill and an honor to do it. And, there's some part of me, man, there's some part of me that thinks, like, you know, that's what I really like to do. And I'm still pretty proud of myself that I've always kept it a hobby, so it's not dirtied up with expectations other than me wanting to play well and be present for it. I should tell you that this conversation with Anna Akana deals with suicide. If you or someone you know are struggling and need support, you can dial 988 from any phone to reach the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. I just want to give you a heads up. It's heavy. We've all had people in our lives who have died from suicide. I remember it very young. I don't know that there was maybe a point where I got sort of numb to the idea of it because I had a father who was a depressive and also, you know, manic as well. There'd be months on end where I'd get phone calls from him telling me he didn't want to live anymore, that he was going to kill himself, and that went on for years. And that's a heavy burden to have someone in your life, in your family, that is plagued with chronic depression and suicidal thoughts. And I grew up in that. You know, my mother had her own issues, but it's interesting to me as I get older and look back on how I was wired, how my brother was wired. My brother's best friend died from suicide, you know, years ago. It had a profound impact on him, obviously. And lately, he's become very involved with support groups around processing that type of grief. And I don't know, you know, it's a difficult thing to sort of unpack your childhood when you're brought up by depressive or mental instability in the home, because you're wired for that. You're just wired for that. You're wired to adapt to that.
you find yourself around those people a lot because it feels like home to you. I remember when I was first in some sort of psychotherapy when I was like 13 years old or so. It feels like about that time I was seeing one of the great child psychologists in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mr. Tom Carey, doing a group therapy thing. And I do remember that I had a very big crush on a girl in that group. And while I was in, you know, not his care, but when I was in that group, she must have been a little older, maybe 14, 15, I don't know, maybe even 16, but I know I was young. But she attempted suicide, and that was the first time I remember really, really, really dealing with that. And it's really hard to wrap your brain around it. It's really hard to even understand why or how that happens. But I do remember going to visit her in, it was either a hospital or perhaps some sort of mental hospital after the case, and she had bandages on her wrists. And, you know, and Tom had said I could go visit her. And I just remember we were listening to Steve Miller Band, and she was just sort of playing air guitar with these bandages on her wrists. And I was just starting to think about that, just how in my life, I guess because of how I'm wired emotionally, that I do find myself in relationship with people who have mental and emotional issues, as do I. And I guess that's the life's work. Is trying to, you know, trying to accept that and trying to have some normalcy in your life. But, you know, in talking to Anna about this stuff, I mean, she's obviously processed her grief and the experience of you know, her sister in her own way and choosing to perform about it and write about it and also sort of do these YouTubes. Is that how the kids say it? YouTube videos that are really focused on dealing with grief and mental health issues. And I guess I don't know if I do that specifically, but certainly we talk fairly openly about a lot of different things here that have an effect on people's, you know, mental stability, whether it's addiction or depression or whatever. A lot of artists have it. A lot of people have it. And we talk fairly frankly and openly about it. And I think that's helpful. And I do see that I do get a lot of emails from people that find solace and some peace of mind by not feeling so alone when this stuff is talked about candidly. You know, I choose humor. You know, Anna's choosing humor. And I do believe that it's helpful. If it's not, it doesn't solve the problem, but it does put a different frame on it. And it does sort of demystify or disarm it a little bit, that is grief and the shock of tragedy. And I really think it's some of the best kind of comedy if you can go that deep with it and find those places. But as I get older, I realize that it doesn't necessarily resolve anything, but it does open up the possibilities of framing it differently. And also, you know, being more public with your feelings about it, because grief and tragedy are pretty much guaranteed in life, and you know, humor, but and also just sort of like allowing yourself to feel the feelings are very important. And again, I want to say before I start this conversation that it does deal with suicide. And again, if you or someone you know are struggling and need support, you can dial 988 from any phone to reach the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. But this is not a depressing conversation. And she's definitely doing a lot of stuff. This is me talking to Anna Akana. Like, I'm totally attached to cats. I'm totally codependent in my life. And like up there, I think about these things, but I don't wake up in it.
Yeah, no, I feel like being on location is such a reprieve sometimes, because then you don't have to worry about the cats. There's nothing you can do. There's like a sort of a, like, I'm not in control anymore because that's over there.
I know, but even though that's very sober.
Yeah.
And I think in my better moments, if I work that muscle, mm-hmm. I can work it. Mm-hmm. But my brain doesn't want to.
I think it's about time you conquered your brain.
Yeah.
You're old enough now. Like, I'm old. What else you got to do? Do it.
AF.
Yeah. Work on it.
I do work on it.
Do some mirror work.
What's mirror work?
Mirror work is when you, it sounds so fucking kitschy, but it's like when you look in the mirror and you do affirmations of the things you want to believe.
So what are yours?
A lot of mine actually have already come true or I've done. So
you've manifested them?
I've manifested them.
You believe that?
I do.
Well, what were they?
Well, one was like, you know, up-leveling my self-esteem, stop like feeling like I need to control everything in my life to feel happy, to feel like an inherent sense of trust that everything is going to work out and be fine, even when it doesn't seem like it is.
Yeah.
And then there was also dumb little shit that I was like, maybe I'll just try to manifest this and see yeah. if it works. Yeah.
And so what's your manifestation rate?
Oh,
like 80%?
I don't know. I don't do the math on it. But so far, I think it's good.
I don't know, man. Here's the deal with you. Because I met you at my show, and then I saw you at the gym. But like, there's this thing that's happening now where all of a sudden I'm just old.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what's going on.
It's time.
It's time to be old and not yeah. know what's going on. Yeah. I know. It's yeah. unavoidable.
Yeah.
But like, I didn't know that you like were this, you know, content producing animal.
What can I say?
That... And that, you know, because I saw the show about your sister, and like, I just don't know what anyone's up to, and everyone kind of build their own world, mm-hmm. their own little show business, which you seem to have done.
Yeah, I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I didn't know that. Now I do. Why would I?
What am I supposed to do? Be like, hey, Mark, I'm a content yeah. baron. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, yeah, that would be good.
Yeah?
Yeah, so I
mean,
can
we did talk on Instagram, so I was like, you have the ability to see.
Well, yeah, but then so much of it is on YouTube and everything else, but yeah. I didn't know like your comedy history because I can't keep up anymore. But I did see the show and I found it, you know, dark and funny, and there are just some disturbing moments.
Yeah. What was disturbing to you?
In a way.
The hair?
Yes. It is.
I love it.
But I don't want to ruin anything for Edinburgh because you're going to slog through a whole fucking month there.
I am. I don't know why. I think I'm going to regret it. I think I'm deeply going to regret it.
That thing traumatized me more than almost anything else doing that festival.
Did you do it once, twice?
I'm never going back. I did it once.
You did it once? And you're
for
like
that
never
full
again.
Month thing.
Was it still rewarding even though it was the worst thing ever?
Well, I wasn't really doing a one-person show.
Okay.
And I was up there on a double bill. And, you know, it was produced, so I didn't have to... you know, invest my own money. But like the whole, and I wasn't known really. And I didn't know that if you're on a double bill, that implies that you're green or something.
Mm.
It was just a slog.
Yeah, yeah.
And the audiences were light yeah. most of the time.
Yeah, that's
awesome. And it's just like, you know, hundreds of other shows, people handing out flyers. Yeah. And I'm like, and I just gone through a separation from my second wife.
Oh.
And I was like leveled. I was an emotional mess.
Yeah.
And I was in another country and I couldn't get nicotine gum. It was bad.
They didn't have nicotine gum?
No, you had to get, when I was there, you had to get it from a doctor.
Oh God, and you weren't drinking at the time. So I have no vices.
Yeah, and the nicotine, I can't, fuck it. What? Anyway, have a good time.
Thank you. I'm gonna try to just think of it as a boot camp experience and write and read and
okay.
Show
so let's do it because now I need to know about you. Where'd you grow up?
My dad's military, so I moved every 2 years. But like, I've been in LA longer than I've been any place else.
But like every 2 years, like throughout your entire childhood?
Yeah.
What was he in the military?
He was an aerospace engineer for the Marine Corps, so he worked on a lot of jets. And then after 9/11, he handled all the Western Hemisphere like war strategy stuff.
What do you mean handled it?
It was classified. I just know that he deployed many people to many places.
What's his rank?
He retired as a lieutenant colonel. He was supposed to be a commander, but there was this big like hubbub where he actually turned it down because there was some kind of mission coming up. And he knew that if he was in that position, he would put his men above whatever his commands were. And whoever actually got the promotion, it means like you would be a traitor to your country. You would have a trial within the military.
So he would be the fall guy?
Yeah. Well, not the fall guy, but he wouldn't have put his men in a dangerous situation, where they were sure to die.
Yeah.
So he turned down the promotion. And whoever it was that got it, I think, went to jail.
Really?
Yeah. For also disobeying.
That's crazy. Disobeying, yeah. Putting the men in
danger. Yeah.
In a situation that would not end well no matter what.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then he retired?
Yeah, he retired. He was forced to retire. He did 26 years and they were like, you got to go. Get out of here.
So where did you live, all these different places?
A bunch of the South, like North Carolina. We moved like every 6 months between the South when I was really young. And then Japan, Hawaii, California.
Those sound pretty good.
Yeah.
The South doesn't sound great. And I'll get flack for saying that. North Carolina is pretty.
North Carolina is beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's all beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember the South. So it was fine.
What do you remember?
I remember my parents couldn't understand me because a Southern accent is the first accent I had. So they would be like, I don't know what she's saying.
And your dad's Filipino?
No, my dad's Japanese Hawaiian. My mom's half Filipino, half European.
Half European. Mm-hmm. Just general.
Spanish, French, English, German.
So how did they meet?
My mom was a waitress when she was 17 and my dad was a GI over in the Philippines. And he walked into the restaurant and was like, oh, I love her. And then I think he was engaged before my mom, but she smoked weed. So he was like, I don't want to be with you anymore. And then
the fiance?
The fiance, yeah.
Yeah.
She was also in the military. And my dad broke up with her because she was a stoner.
Yeah.
And then married my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that when she was what, 17?
18.
Really? And how old was he?
He's 11 years older. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And then after that, that's when they moved to the South? He was rising up?
Yeah, yeah. He brought her to the States. And it was weird because they had a hard time dating. They did like long distance for a little bit because my mom likes to nap. So she overslept on both of their first dates.
Yeah.
So he bought her an alarm clock. And then I guess on their first date, she like farted or something. And my dad was like, oh, my God. Huh? No, that's what she says. She says she knew he was the one because she farted really loud. And he asked her if she had stepped on a frog. Uh-huh. And she was like, what a gentleman. And then I was born. That's why I'm here.
It's so funny. He didn't want to be with the stoner, but the person that can't wake up to go on dates is okay.
I know, with lots of flatulence. I was like, okay, Dad.
The gassy girl.
Yeah. I was like, what did you see in her? Yeah.
And they're not married anymore?
No, they still are. Yeah.
That's crazy.
They're in the Philippines together. It's Father's Day there today.
Did you call?
I sent a WhatsApp. He doesn't like for me to call unless there's something he can explain to me. So,
like what? What do you rely on your dad to explain to you at this point?
Sometimes I'll be like, what's the difference between a Roth IRA and a SEP IRA? Or my motorcycle stalled. What is the troubleshooting I can do?
You have a motorcycle?
I did. I had sold it. But like when I did have one, he loved it because he could explain a lot of the mechanics.
What kind
of
motorcycle?
It was like a little Honda 250cc. It was like a little rebel.
What stopped you from driving that around still? Dying?
Someone hit me, yeah. Someone knocked into me. So I was like, I'm good.
That moment you realize like, oh, I can't, a car will kill me easily.
Yeah, oh, I'm 90 pounds wet. I was like, I'm going to die. So,
yeah.
So I sold it.
So when do you remember, you know, consciously wanting to do show? So your sister who passed away and killed herself. Was how much younger?
She was 13. I was 17. So
I don't mean to be callous about it.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Yeah. She was the youngest, and then I have a brother who's 3 years younger than me.
So she was the youngest. So there's how many years difference?
4 years between me and her.
Uh huh.
Yeah. So I was 17. She was 13 when she passed away.
When she died.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So where'd that happen?
That was in Temecula, California. So we moved out from Hawaii to here, which was kind of a culture shock for us because when we lived in the South, we didn't realize that we were any different from anyone else. We were the only Asians on military bases, but we were too young to understand.
Yeah.
And no one in the military was really racist to you. It was like kind of a really lovely environment.
Really?
Yeah. There was so much camaraderie. The only people we hated were like Army or Air Force. You know, everyone was kind of bonded by your respective military branches.
Right.
And then we came to, you know, in Hawaii.
Where
white
were you in
people,
Hawaii?
Eva Beach, like on Oahu.
Uh-huh.
And everyone would bully the white kids. So, like, we were the majority. Same in Japan.
Asian.
Same, yeah. All Asian. And then in California, I was 16. And it's the first time people were like, hey, go back to China, you chink. And I was like, oh, my God, how embarrassing for you.
Where'd that happen?
That was in Temecula. It's really racist.
But, like, in high school? Or
high school, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So the changing school things. Like, did you have that, like, horrible experience that people in the military have where they have to change, they just get new friends?
And I loved it.
You did?
Yeah.
Because you're weird? Or
I think it was just like, I always wanted to be an actor. So every time you went to a new school, you were like, I'm going to try on a different facet of my personality. I'm going to be like the bookworm here.
You were consciously doing that?
Yeah. I was like, let me explore like a different version of myself.
When did you know you want to be an actress?
Like 5.
So like you would move and just get glasses?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Yeah, like change my voice a little bit. Yeah.
And you just commit to it for as long as you were there?
Yeah, just see if I liked it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And well, where you ended up, are you you?
I think so. I think like sense of self continues to change and evolve as you experience things. And for a long time, I was like, do I have a sense of self? Because I moved around so much and tried on all these different things. But I think now, yeah. I think I just try to honor where I'm at. And I'm like, this is who I am right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? Is that still an elusive thing for you? Or do you feel like you've settled into it?
Well, I know that my engine of self is probably slightly different than who I am in the world most of the time.
Mm. In what way?
Well, I think that like emotionally I'm like pretty stunted.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, my sensitivity and my ability to sort of have, you know, grown up emotions that function is stunted. And, you know, and I'm aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the joke I wrote about years ago was the monster I created to protect the child inside is hard to manage.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still think that that's operative, but I think they're closer. And I think that, and I don't know all about this talk about authentic self and shit.
Mm.
You know, because how much can you really do that?
I mean, don't know.
But don't you feel that there is a vulnerability that you keep to yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. Like, I think now more than ever, it's really hard to figure out, like, because anything you put online, even if you're trying to be quote unquote authentic, it's still performative in some way. And I think growing up alongside the internet, my generation has this sort of splintered sense of self where you have your public persona or the way in which you know you're being perceived or you're trying to be perceived versus the way you act when no one's really looking. And so I think I try to marry them as much as I can. Yeah. Like, I want to act the same as I do online as I do in real life, which is like a losing game. Ultimately, I don't think you can 100%. But I don't know. I think that makes sense.
I'm pretty close, though. Like, even when I was doing Instagram Lives, which is not, like, I don't produce stuff like you do. I'm not trying to make a show business. But I've trimmed my nose hairs.
On Instagram Live? I don't know. I don't know. Maybe keep that vulnerability to yourself, Mark.
I don't know. It didn't help anything.
Yeah? You don't feel like you're being authentic in that moment?
No, I do. But I think what ultimately happens, and I'm sure you've experienced this in a different way, but for different reasons, is that ultimately what happens if I'm on Instagram Live for an hour and a half and I'm just having my day and doing that you're not unlike these conversations, you're going to see who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the same with like how I do the podcast. So what happens is people believe they know you.
Yeah.
And I think they do, but I don't know them.
Yeah.
And there's some things that they don't know about me.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes it a little weird. Parasocial relationships are weird.
They are very weird.
And fucked up. Because they have this sense of who you are, and some of it can be real, but most of it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And it became uncomfortable.
Why do you think you, because we've had this conversation about like having stalkers and having people who have like really inappropriate boundaries. Why do you think you continue to engage in that?
I've pulled back a lot.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I don't do them anymore.
Yeah?
Yeah. I won't do it anymore. It's just like there's too much mental illness out there.
Yeah.
And it's just real.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think people who reach a certain level with that stuff are just sort of like, I never look at the comments. I don't even manage my own site anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes just a production outlet. But the way I was engaging with it, I was alone here.
Mm.
And I was in grief. Mm. And I was like, you know, wanting to stay connected to somebody. But still, like, it felt too vulnerable. And it felt like I was, you know, I had no control over people's engagement with me. And, you know, in terms of boundaries, I'm not great at them anyways.
Mm-hmm.
So you just get gracious about it. But I don't know what your experience with the stalker was.
I mean, which one? There's so many.
Well, let's go back. So, so you get, so you, you're in, you find you, the place you were at before you came here was Temecula.
Yes.
And that's where you went to high school?
Yeah. To Chaparral High School.
Yeah. So what's going on with your sister that led up to?
Oh, so basically we encountered racism for the first time really in California. Yeah. So we came to a new school. We were kind of being bullied for being different. And then, you know, you were kind of segregated by race at my high school.
You're hanging out with the Asians kind of thing?
Yeah. The Asians, like, come and they descend upon you and you're dancing for Youth for Christ, even though you don't believe in God. You're like, what is this?
Is that a church?
Yeah, it's like the youths for the Christ, for the Jesus.
Yeah, but wait, is that an Asian thing?
It's a religious thing. It's like an organization to gather together
at
young
high school?
People. No, there was like an organization at the high school, and then you would form dance teams because everyone was like a B-boy or a B-girl, and then they would send you off to competitions, so you would battle other Asians in dance form.
It's not that cult, though, right?
Which cult?
There was a documentary about that cult, that Korean guy who used to have a church.
Oh, my God, I haven't seen this.
Akana or something is the name of the church.
No.
And then he got into management, and he got all these dancers. And he brainwashed them?
I hope that's not the same one.
No, I don't think it is.
I don't think it is.
So no one was making money off you guys?
No. All we just danced and vowed to be celibate.
Is that where you started dancing?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I danced for Jesus to start off.
And how's your relationship with Jesus?
I mean, Jesus is pretty hot, you know? He's got really great abs. He was my sexual awakening. You looked up at that guy
Stop
at
it.
Church, and you were like, oh, my God, what a stunner.
No.
They shouldn't have made him look so cute.
Look at those abs on that cross.
Look at those abs. He died for my sins? Oh, my God, what a selfless gentleman.
Did you believe it?
I did until I had a priest tell me my sister was in hell because she committed suicide. And then I was like, fuck you. Fuck this whole religion. I'm out.
So go back. So you're experiencing racism and it's hard on your sister?
Yeah, she's being bullied. She had a group of white guys basically come up to her in her middle school and say they were going to beat her up after school or something the next day. So she told her teachers. They didn't take it seriously because this is before bullying was really taken that seriously. And then she brought an air gun to school to protect herself. Someone found out about it. She got expelled. And she had, you know, dyslexia, and she had all these, like, learning disabilities that my parents were like, that's not real.
Yeah.
And so she was going through a really hard time, and she was in a new school, difficulty making friends. My dad was not the greatest. You know, being expelled is, like, one of the worst things that can happen to you.
What did he do?
You know, he became kind of abusive in a way and, like, wasn't really nice.
And they didn't believe in psychotherapy or any of that?
No, they didn't believe dyslexia was even real, even though she tested positive for it. And so her school wanted to put her in like a remedial class. And as an Asian family, they were like, absolutely not. Mm. So she ended up committing suicide on Valentine's Day in 2007.
And did you see that coming?
No. No.
Because she's only 13.
She's only 13. I didn't even know you could. I didn't know that was an option. And, you know, I had a lot of guilt that I dealt with afterwards because, like, I'm the last person who saw her alive.
But that wasn't depression.
I don't know. Like, that's the hard thing. It's like, are you depressed or are you just 13 years old going through middle school, you know?
And you're 17.
I was 17. But she was, you know, she was in a new environment. Moving around was hard on her. She had a hard time learning and a hard time making friends. And I think it was an impulsive decision that she didn't expect to be permanent. Because, I don't know how graphic to get, trigger warning, like, she hung herself with a scarf in her closet. And for a long time, we were very confused because she was right next to a toy chest. So at any point, she could have, like, stepped up on this toy chest and ideally, you know, taken the scarf off of herself. So we've kind of come to the conclusion that maybe when she stepped off, you know, it constricted in such a way that it knocked her out. Mm. And she was just there. And my brother found her way too late, unfortunately. But...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was a really... I thought she left a fucking suicide note for, like, half my life. And then I was talking to my dad to verify some stuff for the show, and he was like, oh, no, there's no suicide note. I just read her diary. That's how we knew what happened.
What was in the diary?
Just, like, all the bullying stuff, like, things that
But not a suicide note.
Not a suicide note.
Just what she was going through.
What she was going through. I guess also the last page of it was just, like, I hate you and I hate you. It was, like, a big list of, like, fuck everybody and you know, just, like, an angry.
And your brother found her. That's terrible.
Yeah.
So what did the family do?
we did like one session of group therapy, and then that was it. My parents didn't force us to go to therapy any longer than we wanted to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so you didn't really resolve the grief or really process anything?
No. I mean, I did therapy on my own for like 17 years, but my parents actually wouldn't even talk to me about it until I made it about work, because I was like, oh, I'm back in stand-up. I have a whole hour about Christina. I need to talk about it to verify some things. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, let's chat. Like, what do you need to know?
Oh.
And that's the first time they've opened up about it. So.
Well, what was the impact on the family, you know, generally speaking?
Everyone kind of mourned on their own. Mm. So it was like a really... I mean, I was doing a bunch of drugs. So from like 17 to 19, I would do like MDMA or acid every day by myself, or like just smoke all this weed, like steal a bunch of wine from like a liquor store, yeah, and like just chug it. So I was kind of like not emotionally or mentally present. And so, yeah.
You're being self-destructive.
I think so, yeah.
As a reaction to what? Guilt?
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I said to her was, I hate you, and I'm the last person who saw her. So there was a lot of like, oh, I could have stopped. I directly could have stopped this. She came to me before she did this.
And have you resolved that stuff?
I have. Like, I know it's not my fault. There's obviously things I wish I could have done differently. Because I think it was Valentine's Day, so I was going to the park to like have a picnic with my boyfriend at the time, and I walked by her door, and I remember thinking like, oh, I should go in there and like tell her I'm sorry and that, you know, and yeah. I was like, ah, whatever, fuck it, I'll talk to her later.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, years and years I spent just ruminating. Moment. Yeah. Yeah.
So when do you like, so what, how bad did the drugs get?
The drugs were bad. I mean, I did a lot of it. I think I did ice cream scoops out of my brain with acid and MDMA, and yeah.
Your brain seems all right.
Yeah, it's forgetting a lot of stuff.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many comedians, so I'm like, nice to meet you, and they're like, we did comedy for years together, and I'm like, I have no memory of that.
Really?
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, but I know people like 20, 30 years, I don't know their name.
Oh, that's good. Okay, that's reassuring.
I think that's more a product of self-centeredness.
Self-centeredness? Okay.
Like, you know, you just
or
kind
trauma,
of,
maybe?
Yeah, so maybe.
A little trauma in there.
Yeah, yeah. But like for me, I don't, like, because you just have to grab it and hold it. Mm. It's not just a passing moment, you know, where like, oh yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
But I mean, seriously, guys I should know. Like, I mean, I see them and I'm like, fuck.
I should know this person.
Yeah.
But you recognize their faces, right?
No,
you just don't know their name.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, what's up, buddy?
Yeah.
How you doing, pal?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you stop the drugs?
I did drugs for a long time, Mark. I really liked psychedelics. They helped me deal with my grief. I think I just...
How they help you deal with it?
Because I confronted my mortality at 17 fucking years old. And...
Like, because, like, of which psychedelics? Acid?
Acid really helped a lot.
It helped. It always made me nervous.
Really?
Yeah, I never could really just sort of, like, enjoy the process.
Were you doing it alone with, like,
no,
an intention?
I didn't do a lot of it, but when I did it when I was younger, it was just the panic just took over. It wasn't, you know what I mean? I couldn't just sort of, like, here we go. It was more like, oh, fuck, what's happening?
Yeah. Here? Have you done ayahuasca?
No, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, maybe you shouldn't. It's really gross.
No, I mean, what is that?
It's like...
I know what it is, but it's like... It just seems like bullshit to me. Like, you know, the guy who used to be a barista is now a guru, and, you know, he's walking around giving everyone a bucket.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the power of psychedelics, and I believe that they can, you know, permanently change the way you see things because of what you see on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that the long-term benefits are probably limited.
I don't know. I think it depends on truly how much you want to change and how you're approaching it. Because has it been commercialized and co-opted by the West? For sure. But it is still ultimately, you know, if you approach it the way it's intended to, I think in an indigenous culture where you're like, I have something I'm bringing to the table that I want to work on and change, I think it can be really beneficial.
Yeah.
I do think people abuse it a little too much. Like they go a little too much where I'm like, oh, get a fucking stamp card at this point. But,
yeah, you're just like tripping balls twice a month.
Yeah, you're just like rocketing
with
yourself
a license.
To the moon.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, like, no,
it's good.
Yeah, yeah. I'm taking
spiritual care
of myself.
Yeah.
When do you start doing comedy?
I started when I was 19 after I saw Margaret.
So you're doing a bunch of acid and ecstasy and you're still sad, but you're not feeling the feels properly.
Correct.
And you see Margaret's show where?
I don't remember. I was high, Mark.
But it was here in L.A.?
I think you moved?
It was, or you just came down?
No, I was still in Temecula. So maybe it was like Oceanside or something. But I
What year was that?
2009?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember the periods of Margaret. Because, I mean, I've known her forever. Like, I knew her back in San Francisco.
Wow.
When she was doing the, you know, that juice place. So, but she's gone through a lot of shit.
Yeah, she really has.
So what did you see when you saw her?
I don't remember the exact jokes.
No, but I mean, like, what was the vibe? What was the feeling?
I mean, it was just like, I'd never seen an Asian woman do stand-up before.
Right. There weren't that many,
There was like Margaret and that's it. Like most of the well-known Asian female comedians today are ones I started out with around that era where.
That's interesting. There really wasn't. Like when I was at the Comedy Store as a doorman in the late 80s, there was a woman named Tamayo. Tamayo Otsuki. But she did like a very broad caricature.
Yeah.
No, it was just sort of like it was at that time, Mitzi, it was like Yakov Smirnoff, but Asian.
Got it.
You know, the point of view was of a stereotypical Asian woman in a way.
Whereas Margaret, you know, she has her mom voice and stuff like that, it's so good.
It's the best.
But it still felt so anachronistic and rooted in like reality and was representative of like an Asian woman I'd never seen before. You know, Margaret's so cool. She's like covered in tattoos. And,
she's also dirty.
She's dirty.
Yeah.
She's like, yeah. And so I saw her and I remember just leaving and the sort of crushing weight of my sister's death kind of came rushing back in. And I was like, oh, for 30 minutes, it really wasn't at the top of my mind, which was the first time that happened. I like laughed in earnest watching her and I was like, wow, that is like an amazing gift this woman gave to me and I would love to give that to someone else.
Huh. That's interesting. But it was complete sort of identification and the idea that, you know, comedy can make you feel better.
Yeah.
But you'd never had that before watching comedy or being?
No, I'd never really been exposed to stand-up before. My dad was like really obsessed with harem anime. So all we watched was harem anime.
Okay.
You know? So
that's pretty good.
So yeah, that's all we watched growing up.
Is anime.
Anime.
The strong stuff, Japanese.
Yeah.
What's harem anime?
Harem anime, you'd like it, Mark. It's where seven different women are really in love with and chasing this like one mid man for no discernible reason. Uh-huh. And they're all obsessed with him and trying to fuck him. Yeah. And so like we would just watch that as a family. They still watch it.
Really?
Yeah. My dad's watching Is It Wrong to Try to Pick Up Girls in a Dungeon? And That Time I Got Reincarnated as Slime. Those are his big ones right now.
Interesting that he's kept that going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about anime, but it's like always pretty captivating.
Yeah, it's
But this seemed borderline porn.
Oh, it's very horny. They're just naked all the time, like flying around in a hot spring.
And he just saw it like, well, they're cartoons, so the kids can watch them.
Yeah, they'll love this.
So no comedy.
No comedy.
And what was your brother doing? How was he handling everything? Are you guys close?
We're very close now, but we were very separate, like separately grieving at the time. And then he kind of came into my high school and I kind of took him under my wing and we got closer from that. But yeah, I don't know. My family just kind of grieved very, very. I mean,
do you think that's specifically Asian?
I think it's specifically us, like our environment. My parents are very unique in the sense that they were gamers when I was growing up. They're very obsessed with pop culture. My dad was like a World of Warcraft fanatic. My mom loved Nintendo. They would take us to wait in line at midnight for like the next Harry Potter book, but they'd only buy two copies and my parents got to read them first while we had to wait.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our culture growing up was grab your dinner, go in your room, go on your computer and like play your little games.
Yeah.
So we were always very independent. Like everyone can be in the same room, but we're all on our own devices or doing our own thing.
So you didn't get that specific. Do you think, and I'm, you know, I'm not, I don't know what I'm saying or if it's racially insensitive, mm-hmm. but it seems like in a way you're mixed race Asian, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like that the people that are solidly ethnically one thing, mm-hmm. especially Asian, they create this kind of ambition in their kids to prove themselves.
Yes.
Did you grow up with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my dad's military. So right. there was a
combination of Japanese and American military.
Yes. But my dad's also like, he wanted me to be a Marine Corps officer. So,
really?
Yeah, because his dad was one. He was one. So he had it in his head, like the oldest should be in the military. So I was raised in like ROTC camps every summer.
What?
Having to do the electives. Like I fully was like, yeah, I'm going to go into the military and either be like a doctor or a pilot. And so,
how did you avoid that? Is that something that got hijacked by your sister's suicide?
Yeah. I was like, I don't want to fucking do this. And then I took organic chemistry in like a community college and was like, no.
Wow. So that saved you from military life in a way.
Yeah.
But you seem to have the discipline of a military person.
I do.
So you see Margaret and then you decide, I'm going to do this?
Yeah. I fill out a notebook of everything I think is funny. It wasn't. And then I worked at GameStop at the time. GameStop.
So you're a gamer too?
I had to stop. I get real addicted real fast. So I don't have them anymore.
What were your games?
I mean, I really liked RPGs. Yeah. I wasn't like a player-by-player fight kind of gal. Everything had to kind of be third person. So I liked Gears of War or anything like that. Call of Duty was a little too much being first-person POV. But I had to stop. I had a Vive for a while, which was really fun. But then I was like, virtual reality is way cooler than reality. And I don't want to exist in reality.
So you had to like treat it like drugs?
Yeah, yeah.
And just go cold turkey?
Yeah. I had to just sell it all.
Really? And this is before you started doing comedy?
No. Actually, yeah. I sold it all when I moved out to LA when I was 21. So I sold my whole gaming collection in order to fund my move out here.
So you moved from Temecula to here.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd never done comedy?
No, I was doing open mics.
Where?
Like for 2 years.
Driving down?
Driving down from Temecula every day.
2010?
Yeah, 2010, 2011.
And you're doing like the mics?
The mics. Well, the first time I ever did comedy, Kyle from GameStop, my assistant manager, was like, I run a comedy show in Oceanside. I'll give you 8 minutes. And I was like, okay, sure. So my first time on stage, I did 8.
How'd that go?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah. It was probably horrible. But
did you get laughs,
though? It was all my friends and family coming to support me. So like they were nice. They were being real nice.
Couldn't really gauge.
Oh, it was horrible. My jokes then were so bad.
Yeah, what was the area?
I think it was like, I would compare seeing a dick for the first time to like seeing Godzilla or something just do an act out.
That's
and it was
good.
Just so cringe. Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Keep going. But it was so stupid. But I had fun. I really loved it. And my dad camped out for Last Comic Standing with me. And I remember Natasha Leggero was like, that's one of the worst acts I've ever seen. And I was like, I'm memorable. She's going to remember me. Oh my God.
Really? She said that about you?
Yeah.
In the audition?
Yeah. We like had a little pink princess tent and I was like so excited to do it. But like rejection really didn't deter me at that point because I had gone through so much that I was like, I'm
didn't
just happy to be
all.
Here. It didn't hurt at all. I was like, this is nothing compared to my sister's suicide.
Right. Yeah. That's an interesting notion about grief.
Yeah.
That, on some level, you've already been through the worst thing you're going to go through.
Yeah.
And you kind of frame that in your head.
Yeah.
Huh. So, that's interesting.
It
Natasha. Who else was on that panel?
God, I just remember Natasha because I really liked her.
Yeah,
but I really liked her comedy. So I was like, wow, like this is exciting. This is the beginning of my journey.
Yeah, yeah.
1%.
Someone I respect is just shit on me.
Yeah. And,
I don't know. I couldn't take it. Good for you. Yeah. So that didn't deter you and you didn't get on the show, I guess?
No, I didn't get on the show, but it didn't deter me. I actually only started really... only when I started getting better at stand-up did I start to get really nervous on stage.
Who was in the scene? Like, who were you coming up with?
There was Allie Wong.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Atsuko Okotsuka, Jenny Yang.
Allie was around at the mics?
Yeah. In the Bay Area. Like,
yeah,
I would go down to the Bay, yeah.
Oh, where's Temecula?
Temecula is like near San Diego, but like I would do Punchline. There were a bunch of like Asian comedy lineups that I would kind of do.
How'd you get to San Francisco?
I drove.
That's a long fucking drive.
I know, but I would do like a show out there. And so I would hit mics while
I was
out there.
Yeah, because Allie was there. I was there for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And Allie, I remember featured for me or opened for me.
Oh, cool.
Like she was so, she was always very intense. So you're doing mics all up and down. You would drive hours?
Yeah.
That seems like so long.
I didn't mind it at all. I loved
it. Who else was there?
Atsuko Okotsuka.
Oh, yeah.
Was Jenny Yang.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to think who
So there's like a lot of Asians.
A lot of Asian women on the scene, yeah.
Huh. Yeah. And where were you doing it here?
I don't know. The Ha Ha Flappers,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Meltdown Comics, like anywhere I could get up, really.
But did you stick with it?
I did until 2018 when I quit because of that stalker.
So you're going at it, but alongside of that, it seems to me like you're constantly in training for something, almost like martial arts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. When you see me at the gym and yeah, I'm like balancing I'm like, yeah, on a BOSU.
What is she preparing for?
Is she... The end, Mark. I'm preparing for the end.
But you clearly are doing other things. When did you become savvy? Because I don't know when it happened to, you know, posting your own videos, web mm-hmm. series, movies. When did that start to happen?
So I started doing YouTube when I was 22 or 23 because of the frustration of, I mean, you know this, when you're starting out as a comic, you're like kind of doing non-consensual comedy. You're like in a coffee shop or in a laundromat shouting your jokes at people who are not there to listen to you.
Yeah.
And it felt really uncomfortable. And I was like, well, what if I just make a fucking YouTube video and put that online and someone will click it and actually want to engage with me? And so I was doing that in parallel with stand-up. And back in the day, in like—
Was that at the beginning of it all?
Yeah. It was like I'd been doing stand-up for maybe a year or two at that point. And there was almost no Asian representation in traditional media. So all the very first YouTube stars were actually Asian descent.
Huh.
So you had like Community Channel or Michelle Phan or Ryan Higa, like all of these Asian people in different verticals, like beauty or lifestyle or comedy, because we couldn't see ourselves represented anywhere else. So it was actually quite easy to garner an audience on that platform because every Asian was like, oh my God, look, it's someone who looked like the same feeling I had with Margaret.
Yeah. It seems like if you can get yourself out in front of your group, mm-hmm. whether it's Asians or whatever, that they'll show up.
Yeah.
They'll come see you.
Yeah.
And they did?
They did.
So you saw a change in your comedy audience from the YouTube stuff early on?
Yeah. I think I headlined way too, like before I was ready. I was not a great comic.
But you could
by
sell
any
means, tickets.
But I could sell tickets, yeah. So I was, I had like, I went on a tour throughout North America where I was headlining and—
Clubs?
Yeah, or like sometimes colleges, clubs and colleges.
Yeah.
All Asians.
Oh, really? Yeah. And they would come out?
Oh, they would come. The Asians come.
And did you feel you knew you weren't ready to be doing those sets?
Or? Yeah, there's an idea you have of like, I know what great comedy is. I've watched enough of it and I know what I'm saying is not it. And I don't have the technique and I don't have the skill to get there yet, but I'm also not going to get there unless I just keep getting up.
Yeah.
So there was a frustration definitely on my end where like, I really loved doing it, but I knew the material wasn't quite there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you had to stop?
Yeah.
So you were headlining and had you done TV and movies by that point?
Yeah, I'd done a couple of shows.
Yeah?
Yeah, like Disney Channel stuff, MTV, co-star stuff.
What was the biggest part you had?
In my career or back then? I think probably most people know me from Ant-Man. I had like a bit part on Ant-Man.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That was exciting.
It was fun, yeah.
What was the part?
I don't know. They said, the fan people said I talk about Spider-Man. I'm like, the first person to talk about Spider-Man in this universe. And I'm like, okay, cool.
Oh, yeah. So now you're like, you're an important piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. It was, it was Crazy Stupid Fine Writer Chick is the title.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At least I didn't put Asian in there.
I know. Well, it was Nerdy Writer Chick when I booked it. And then everyone was really mad when I showed up. And they're like, where's the Crazy Stupid Fine girl? What is this?
So why did you quit? How did that happen? How did that work?
So I had a lot of online death threats coming in from what I believed to be one person. And a few years prior, do you know Christina Grimmie?
Uh-uh.
She was a YouTuber who was on America's Got Talent, a singer.
Yeah.
And she had been shot by a fan. He like drove across the country, went to her meet and greet. Like she greeted him with arms wide open and he shot her point blank. And so I had someone online who was sending me messages saying, I'm going to come to a show and I'm going to shoot you. And so it felt very plausible.
What did you do about that?
I talked to the police and I was told there's really nothing they can do about it, you know, unless this person actually showed up or revealed themselves as like a burner account. I was told to like increase security on my tour. And so I was doing these shows and really disassociated and having panic attacks on stage and like, you know, looking at everyone in the audience like, is he here? Am I going to die? And I was put on some medication to deal with the anxiety, which just made me feel horrendous.
Like beta blockers?
Yeah, I was on Lexapro, I was on an antidepressant. And
that's how they handle it. There's nothing you can do legally.
Yeah. So
but maybe we can decrease your fear with medication.
Yeah, because I was like, I can't go on. I was ending shows early. I was like forgetting my material. I was so rattled up there that I wanted something.
And then after the show, you're like, is there anyone going to protect me? How am I going to get back to the hotel? Who's going to walk me? That kind of shit.
Yeah, that whole thing. And then it got to the point where I was just like, I don't want this.
Aliases
I don't want to do
at
this.
Hotels?
Yeah. Yeah. I was about to say it. I was like, oh, no, don't say Aurelius. But yeah. I just was like, I can make videos at home in the safety of my home and not deal with
this. So that's so fucked up, though. But so because you got overwhelmed with the anxiety and the fear that you just stopped booking comedy?
Yeah.
And you wouldn't do it here either?
Yeah, no, I quit. I just totally quit.
Holy shit. And then you just, that's when did you retreat into dealing with mental health issues on YouTube?
I had always done it. I had a video go viral called Please Don't Kill Yourself, which I put out in hopes of people who wanted to take their own life would find it. And yeah. then I kind of talked about, like, this is what happens to the family you leave behind or the people who love you. And, like, this is what I've gone through. And, like, think about anyone in your life who loves you. You're putting them through this if you decide to commit this action that's irreversible. And so I had always sort of put very sincere mental health messages in my YouTube content.
From a personal angle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or like parroting my therapist's advice or some shit. Right, like anytime I put advice forward, it's always from a qualified source. It's not my own.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, I think.
Did that pick up? Did that, what started drawing the most followers?
It was that. It was that video, actually, is the most viral thing I've had.
Yeah.
I think in the same sense of your audience, like how you talk a lot about your mental health stuff and people who have been affected by that really resonate it.
Yeah, they feel resonate with it.
Yeah, yeah. So I was doing that in YouTube and making it comedic, but I've made like a video a week for like 15 years. So I don't
still.
Really. Yeah.
When did you get the book deal?
The book was like when I was 27.
So, but after the videos.
After the videos, yes.
So how did that deal work? Did they see the followers and say like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was handed to me because they were like, oh, books are a dying art form. Let's get the internet people to write them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was that called?
It was called Letters to My Little Sister.
And so I imagine that writing that helped you put together the show.
Yeah, honestly, no. Not really.
Well, how did that book go over?
It went well. Yeah, yeah, I heard it. It was translated into Korean. They had like a really beautiful Korean variant cover. It like did well. I think we had a couple of reprintings. But yeah it was fine. I felt obnoxious. I was like, I'm a 26-year-old writing a fucking memoir. This is...
But it's very specific.
I know. But it's like, I was like, this is annoying. But no, I think I told you when I saw you at the gym, like From Bleak to Dark is one of the reasons where I was like, I think I'm ready to do stand-up again. Like I had seen that. I had seen Inside. I'd seen In and of Itself, Nanette, like these shows that tackled deeper, darker issues. And I was like, I want to do that. And I think I'm finally at the skill level of a writer and a performer to do what I wanted to do in my 20s.
Yeah.
So then I wrote this hour in the summer of 2023 and then just started going back.
Is that recent?
Yeah.
And what was how did it feel to get back? Were you doing it in pieces?
No, I did it as it's in its entire iteration.
So you just wrote a one-person show.
Yeah.
And you weren't concerned about, like, did you feel rusty or did you feel... I mean, it's an interesting thing to do that, the one-person show, because I've done it. You know, a couple of times in my life and as a stand-up, but, you know, my chops were pretty in place.
Yeah.
But I felt when I did the one-person show that, like, it's not funny enough.
Mm.
Like when I did Jerusalem Syndrome or the other ones, it was a way to process things and buy you a little wiggle room around laughter.
Mm-hmm. Did you cannibalize any of that for stand-up and make it funnier?
Well, I mean, some of the stuff that was in Jerusalem Syndrome... That was a storytelling thing. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if I cannibalized it, but I did, you know, I was able to work out pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I think that, like, is any of my shows like that, like any of the specials really like that with that kind of structure? I had a real hard time honoring the structure of doing a show that's the same every night. Because when I do stand up, even if I'm recording a special, I like to have room to riff or to find something that happens in the moment. So it feels like...
Crazy.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, mine's so storytelling based that I feel like I can't. But yeah, I think I've seen you a couple times at this hour and you would shuffle things around and it was really interesting to watch.
Yeah. And I just, you know, I need to have that freedom to sort of like find those moments because that's how I write. I mean, you write differently.
Yeah, you write fucking, on stage.
Well, yeah. Because then it's sort of like, you know, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And then I have a spiritual experience.
Wow, your higher power.
The higher power, whatever it is, like, I don't know. I like putting myself in the position to have to be funny. Like, to, okay, I'm going to start talking about this. I don't know where it's going to go.
Wow.
We'll see what happens. And then if something happens, I'm like, look at that magic. Wow. But my point is that you didn't feel confined by a 15-minute set, a 10-minute set, or even a standard headlining set. You could look at it as this completely other thing.
Yeah.
But how did the stalker thing resolve itself?
He started showing up to my house in 2020, so I was able to get a restraining order. So I dealt with that in 2020, went to the courthouse, and got a bunch of therapy. So if I was finally at a point where I was like, okay, I feel safe enough to come back. Although, now there's a new one, but we'll see.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
What do you think that, do you think it's specifically because you're a woman or an Asian woman? Or?
I think it's both. I think it's also like I'm an Asian woman who deals with mental health issues. So there's a lot of people who have like the fetishization, hypersexualization ideals of an Asian woman who is then talking about, oh, these issues, like they're helping me. And now I have this fascination and this is my savior.
Or some of them are thinking like, this one talks.
And she's funny.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, that I don't like. I don't know. You've talked about that a few times. I think that fetishization of Asian people.
Yeah.
What is that about, from your point of view?
What is that about? I mean, racism, I guess. I don't know. I actually was looking into where the trope comes from: Asian women being with white men and like white saviorism in those interracial relationships. And I was able to find out that in the 1800s. You know, Asian women were barred from entering the country, except as prostitutes. So a lot of women who would be brought over from China and sold into brothels could only be saved from those brothels if they were married to Christian men. So there's this group of white women who would actually like take all these Chinese prostitutes and marry them off to like good white men to get them out of these like horrific conditions. And so that's kind of the origin of like the interracial relationship and this idea that that we worship white men because we literally were being saved by them from prostitution in this country to start off.
Right. And then I think all the war brides too.
Yeah.
That was a whole other thing.
Yeah.
People coming back from Korea, Vietnam.
Yeah.
Huh. So you got a new stalker. The other one's manageable.
Yeah.
And you're doing this show. Where do you start working it out? Dynasty?
I started at Lyric Hyperion. It was much more intimate, like smaller.
So it was like 40, 50 people.
It's like 90. And then I started moving to Dynasty, which I quite like. And then I did a tour in the spring, and now I'm going to do Edinburgh and then another tour in the fall.
When you go out on tour, where are you going?
Helium? What kind of, helium?
You did a helium for what, a one night or a run?
I did one night.
In Portland?
Yes, I did Portland.
How'd that go?
It was good.
Now, is it mostly Asians?
A lot of Asians. There's like either Asians, old white men, the white boyfriends of the Asians, and yeah, that's the demographic.
Huh.
Yeah.
And what's the feedback been generally?
It's been really good. Honestly, yeah. I had a couple of psychologists come up to me and be like, the way you handled this was so well done from
Isn't
my
good?
View. Yeah, it's great.
When you do bits about mental illness and the psychologists are like, yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, responsible.
You nailed it. Yeah. Yeah, but the hair part was like a bit.
You didn't love it?
Well, no, it was cringy.
No, you loved it.
But isn't it supposed to be a little like,
it is,
what?
It is a little like, yeah. I think it's like a fun little surprise.
I know. Well, I mean, you were having fun with it.
I love it.
But it's one thing to sort of conjure, you know, somebody's life, you know, and your relation to it. But then to have this horrendous artifact.
I don't know if it's horrendous. It's very soft and it's very silky. I think it looks horrendous now because I did...
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying the effect of it brings, it's almost like a ritual artifact, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you have this piece of the person.
Yeah.
And as an audience member, you can't disconnect that.
No. I like it because it really makes, there's something about it, I think, that grounds people into realizing, like, she was a real person.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, I'm like, this was her hair. This is her braid that was lopped off. Like, I don't know. It's my favorite part of the show. And my agent was like, I don't know. It's pretty fucking weird. Maybe you shouldn't do that. And I was like, if I can't do the hair, I don't want to do the entire show.
Yeah.
I love it.
So so you did Portland, and what are the other venues? How does it work?
I don't know. No, Mark, I don't have a memory.
But I'm just saying, are they rock clubs? Are they black box theaters? Yeah, I mean, Portland, Helium's a comedy club. Yeah. I'm just wondering what the venues.
Usually, my team was like, let's put you in like alt venues. So I know I'm doing a lot of those. I did like the Crocodile. I'm trying to think what else.
Didn't you just do Chicago?
I did Chicago. I did Dunn Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was really great. Chicago was awesome.
It's a great city.
Chicago and San Diego were like two of the greatest shows.
Right? San Diego, what is that about?
San Diego is just down to fuck. They're down to clown.
Yeah.
Like, they are like, whoa! They were like screaming all the dark stuff that I had to build permissions into. San Diego didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
They were just like cracking up. Even
I was surprised the last time I did San Diego.
Yeah?
Yeah, just because like... I wasn't even going to add a second show, and then it sold out, and that's what, the night I broke my foot.
Oh.
So I was like,
did they love it?
Well, no, but I was just walking around on my heel. I didn't know it was broken.
That's when you didn't know it? You didn't have the cast yet?
No. It was like the day of.
So you did two shows with a broken foot?
Yes. I know. Hobbling around on my heel. Yeah. I knew it was fucked up.
Why are you hobbling around? Sit down, Mark.
I did. I sat down for a while, but there's a couple bits I had to get up. So what's the goal?
I think I just want to, my goal would be I want to sell it to a network and then put it out there. And then from there, I don't know.
So you want to do a special?
I want to do a special, yeah. I want to sell it.
But you don't want to do an extended run?
I will do one once I sell it. I'm doing a fall tour. I'm doing all new cities. And then.
But usually one-nighters?
Yeah, unless it sells out really well, then I'll add a second night. But
seems like some of them are selling out.
Yeah, they're selling out pretty quick. But yeah. I don't know. I like to go to bed early, you know, and I'm not really a. Yeah, let's be out all night and get as many shows in as we can. Like, I'm going to be 35. I'm pretty okay.
What? You're going to be 30? What does that even mean? You're going to be 35? Well, it's time to rest?
Yeah, I need my beauty sleep.
Yeah.
I want my 9 hours.
Nine?
Yes, Mark. Women have hormone fluctuations, and science says we need 9 hours.
I can't even get 7, man.
Well, take some Ambien. I don't know. Take some melatonin.
So the idea, have you had people come out and see it?
Yeah.
And where are they at?
They're pretty good. They're pretty interested. So that's great. I have a couple more networks to pitch to that I'll do post-Fringe. But I'm hoping...
What are you thinking? Like Amazon, Hulu, Netflix?
Yeah, I think Netflix
HBO.
Would be my goal. Netflix would be my number
that's
one.
That's the big reach.
Yeah. Most
But
hours.
I don't know if they're like ponying up the bread.
That's fine. I'm okay Maybe on bread. I've got enough bread.
Right. Where'd all your bread come from?
YouTube.
Really?
And then investing.
Okay, so how does that... Oh, that's good. But how does that work?
Basically brand deals. So there was actual AdSense, which
some of your, like, you know, look what I'm drinking things.
Yeah, yeah. That shit. Although Liquid Death will not sponsor me.
Really?
I know. I'm really upset.
I think I may have done maybe one ad for them, and then they sent me like 100 cases.
That's why I want to do an ad for them, so I can have unlimited Liquid Death.
They seem to be doing all right.
Yeah. Look, you have one right now.
I know. So it's all ad deals?
It's all ad deals, yeah. Usually Squarespace. Squarespace, who's my daddy, my biological father.
Yeah, ours too.
Oh, really? Yeah, we love them. I fucking love them.
Yeah.
In all my years of working with them, there's only one video. I think I'm the reason that they have to QC your ad reads now, because before you used to just like...
What's QC?
QC, like quality control. Oh, like, okay. They have to watch it before they approve. Yeah. Because before... I made this video called Here's What I'll Do to Your Dick. And it was for women to send to men who had sent you an unsolicited dick photo.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just me like chopping up vegetables or, I don't know, throwing zucchini into the sun.
Sure.
And Squarespace was like, internally, we love it. But this looks like genital mutilation. So
Not
good for the brand. And after that, they were like, yeah, you got to send us every video for approval from now on.
So over the course of the entire arc of your YouTube postings, you've had just numerous brand deals.
Yeah.
And that's where it all came from.
That's where it all came from. That and, you know, like acting and voiceover and all that, like a Taco Bell commercial where it was the back of my head hanging up a green screen sign. They used it in every single Taco Bell commercial. So I got mad residuals from that like
really?
Paid off my car. It was great.
And what about like other stuff? I feel like you're preparing for combat. Do you do like, have you done like, what are you doing?
I do like a lot of like ninja role, you know, samurai, you know, I'm the chosen one and I've got to train.
Do some of that?
Yeah. So that's why you see me on the BOSU all the time.
And what was the feature you made? Did you make a movie on your own?
On my own? No.
No. Oh, you never did like full YouTube movie?
No.
Or just miniseries?
No, that's a different Asian, Mark.
I don't know. Well, I just see, like, I see some of your stuff because I didn't follow anybody on Instagram, like 8 people.
Yeah.
But then, like, when I had some guy take it over, he's like, you should follow more people. So then I started following you, mm-hmm. and I started following a bunch of other people. And now, like, I just have to, you know, see what I'm not doing.
Oh, but, no.
No, but you do. It seems like you do a lot of things that take the day to do.
I'm really good at bulk shooting, I think, at this point. So I'll take 2 weekends out of the month and I can shoot, you know, months and months worth of content.
And you write it all?
I write it all, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And it's still good. The ads are coming in still.
The ads, I mean, I'm going to milk this baby into the ground, Mark. Like,
that's amazing.
As long as I can, you know?
Yeah. Well, why not?
Why not? Just take that money, invest it into GameStop stock, call it a day.
So you do all the investing. You're a gambler.
Not a gambler. No, I do very basic bitch options trading.
Oh, really?
I do like covered calls on blue chip stocks. It's all very conservative.
Well, it's smart. I don't even know where my money is half the time.
Oh, no.
Well, whatever.
Whoa. Gotta get it.
No, I mean, I trust the person I have in charge of it. Okay. And I seem to be fine.
Okay. Hopefully.
So what would stop you from self-producing? Like if Netflix wanted to, would you self-produce it?
Yeah, maybe.
Because that's why it seems like that's sort of what they're doing.
Yeah, I think they'll give you a couple hundred grand. Yeah, yeah, they give you a couple hundred grand, you go shoot it.
Yeah, and then they'll put it on, see what happens.
Yeah.
That'd be the good thing, right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So now Edinburgh, you're just going to run it? You have a theater? You know where you're going to be?
I do. I'm doing the show and tell Pleasance Courtyard. I'm at 5:30 every day except for Mondays. I'm taking Mondays off so I can go see the castle.
So, it's right up there.
Yeah, I got to go see it.
You'll see it every day.
Yeah, I got to go hang out.
Well, that's one day.
Well, no, I'm going to go to the castle multiple times, Mark.
Why?
I don't know. It's a castle. All How right. often do we get to see a
it's
castle?
Beautiful. It's beautiful. There's nothing not beautiful about Edinburgh. It's beautiful. So you're the 5:30 show at a venue that seats how much?
90?
What's it called?
Show and Tell the Pleasance Courtyard.
The Pleasance Courtyard.
Yes, upstairs.
And then you got to run around and hope the Scotsman reviews it.
Yeah, actually, press has been going pretty well. Like, I'm surprised because there's like 4,000 shows. Yeah.
Like what?
Like the Times, they were like, yes, the Sunday.
They already
Scotsman?
Saw it or they're just excited?
Oh, I have like a, they pick like 5 comedians to put in the newspaper, I guess, when it's your debut. And so they were like, we've picked Anna because she's gone through a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll have the next baby reindeer.
Oh, my God. One can only hope. I don't know. I loved Baby Reindeer, but it's like one of those shows where you're like, I love it. Never again. Never
Dude,
watching it again.
It fucking destroyed me.
Yeah. It was so intense.
I couldn't stop watching it.
Yeah.
Because at some point, you know, like, this is real.
Yeah.
This happened to this guy.
Well, it's also interesting because it was 2 Fringe shows put together. And I was like, this is why it feels so fucking sharp. Because it's like 10 years of his work in one show.
Yeah, but to put it into, to make it a series that has that kind of drive in it. And he's a very good actor, that guy. I don't know how he is as a stand-up, but he's a good actor.
Yeah. So, I was like, did it resonate with you? Like the
well,
stalker
yeah, because,
portions?
You know, when, but the stalker portions, but also the portions of his relationship with himself and then also his, you know, understanding of the stalker was kind of like crazy.
Because I imagine that's so different for you. With me, it's like, if I have a stalker, I'm like, am I going to be raped and murdered? Do you ever feel like that? Or is there an inherent sense of like, I could punch this lady in the face and I'm fine?
Yeah, I don't really think that. I don't think that they're going to rape me, but murder is always there.
Yeah, murder's on the table.
But also just that, I think the fact about that situation, because I had one parking in front of my house for weeks.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, when you engage them as people, you realize like, oh, there's a problem here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and how I know it's not my responsibility, but if you start to look at them as people with a problem, which I think he did kind of, yet his insecurity wouldn't allow him to have boundaries around it, that, you know, what that says about yourself and how you handle that is really the crux of what he was dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, it was a lot.
Yeah. It was really intense. I really loved the portrayal of how he handled that and how you do ultimately empathize with these people, especially when you can tell they're mentally ill.
Oh my God.
You know, there is a sense of like, oh, I feel really bad for you, but like, I'm also sort of a victim of this situation.
And then there's also the whole B story about his, you know, sexual trauma.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to make it in show business.
Yeah. Have you had to deal with that?
What, sexual abuse?
Yeah. Like from a man?
Well, I've been talking about that babysitter thing.
Oh, yeah. So, wait, you have no memory if that actually happened to you, like if it ever got to a...
Yeah, did it actually happen? Well, what happened was I remember it, you know, whatever is there now.
Yeah.
Just being in that position to, you know, in terms of having, you know, a teenage boy with his dick out and me and my brother or a little kid sitting there dealing with that. I mean, that's something.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I really believe that it didn't happen.
Did you ever talk to your brother about it?
Yeah.
Does he have any memories?
Well, he remembers it happening, but we're still pretty set on the idea that we didn't, you know, it didn't kind of go through.
Yeah.
And my dad sort of confirmed that. But like, you know, talking about that, you know, and talking about trauma in general, like from Bleak to Dark, you know, in talking about Lynn's death, after you figure out how to make that funny, it takes you into a different zone of your abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so entering this new hour, I was like, well, what have I got that that I can process, you know, in a way that would be helpful, but also, you know, put me on the spot to deal with it in that way. Like, I don't feel, and that's the point of the bit, I don't feel traumatized or victimized, but, you know, also I haven't investigated it. So to do it comedically, I think I got the chops for that from dealing with her death.
Mm-hmm. And that's what this new hour is?
No, it's just a bit in the new hour.
Okay.
I mean, there's other bits. I mean, that's a heavy bit. It took a lot to balance. I mean, that's the thing about talking about that type of real shit, whether it's death or trauma or abuse, is that, you know, how do you make it not horrible?
Well, it's funny. The two times I saw you at Dynasty, you had flipped that bit in the hour. And I remember noticing when you had put it in the front half, the audience did not like it. We were like not... It was like too much off the bat. And I think it also came off of like a joke, the new joke you have about Kit. And so it like back to back, it almost read as like, oh, this is odd.
Yeah.
But in another show, you had put it in the back half. And it also came after your mom and that squinched up lunch bag or something.
Well, that was part of it. That's part of the bit. And now I've added the character of the babysitter.
Oh, I haven't seen
that. Dude, it's crazy.
Yeah, is it killing?
It's crazy. It's become this huge thing that goes a place that you could never imagine.
Is it him in the doing the open mic in Alaska?
Yeah.
Okay. I think you had mentioned that at the show, but there was no actual act out of what that act is.
Dude, I'm writing jokes for that guy.
Oh my God, we love it.
It's
we love it. We love to see it.
Well, good luck in Scotland.
Thanks. Any wrecks?
I don't remember.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I mean, like, you're going to be in this. It, you know, I think the best thing, especially because, you know, you're young and sociable, is that you're going to be around hundreds you're going to be around hundreds of performers.
Mm-mm.
And there's going to be a lot of shows to see. And you're going to have time to do that if you choose to do that. Like, there's got to be at least, 100, 200 shows up there.
There's 4,000 this year.
What?
There's 4,000.
Oh. And then there's also big shows. But there's a lot to do. And I think if you're able to have fun among your peers...
We'll see. I mean, I'm a very boring person, so we shall see.
All right, we'll break a leg. Thanks for talking.
Thank you.
There you go. That was, I thought it was pretty chipper talk. Kept a nice level about some pretty heavy stuff. Again, if you need support around the issues of suicide or other emotional distress, you can call 988 from any phone and talk to someone at the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Anna's show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival is going on now through August 24th. Hang out a minute, folks. Hey, people. Sign up for the full Marin today and you get every episode of WTF ad-free plus bonus episodes twice a week. This week we just posted more outtakes and extra material that didn't make it into recent episodes. What is it about your character? And either you're, you know, just gung-ho about minority rule and imposing selective morality on your fellow Americans who just want to live their life, or you're some sort of religious weirdo that believes somehow that that Trump is somehow, forgivable in light of the fact that sometimes God chooses flawed messengers. Sometimes you need a flawed messenger to facilitate what you want to facilitate as a, you know, Christian righteous person. And look, there are other religious movements that are problematic, but someone who is devoid of religion, you know, has to question this deal that you're making. This, this, you know, accepting, rationalizing, and forgiving, probably arguably one of the most morally bankrupt public figures to have ever been culturally powerful. To forgive that in the name of your understanding of God. God sends flawed messengers sometimes to facilitate his plan. Yeah, yeah. He there was a big one that he actually kicked out, Satan. And I would say, and this is not overreacting, this is not, I would say just in terms of what I've read, the poetry, the verse, that really there's been nobody closer to the character of Satan in my lifetime than this newly convicted felon of an ex-president. To get the full Marin, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a bit of guitar from the vault. Monkey, La Fonda, Cat Angels everywhere.